Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Yaakov Zion's here. Just welcome. I see some familiar faces and some new ones. And the topic today is about the sale of chametz and other items throughout the years and throughout the ages. And it's a topic that I've worked on for a number of years, and I hope to gain insight from everyone's questions and definitely gained from the preparation of this, and if you anything's not understood, please ask. So the primary thing here is selling chametz, and we're going to deal with a couple of other things that are similar as well. There are a number of things that are problematic for a Jew to do or to partake in, and sometimes the selling it to a non-Jew will be the workaround. Chametz is the primary one. And let's break down chametz into at least two parts here. Number one is that over the Pesach holiday, over Passover, we're not allowed to own chametz. In addition to not eating it, we're not allowed to own it. Obviously, non-Jews are not included in this. Non-Jews only have 7 Noahide commandments, and they are fully allowed to own chametz. There is an additional layer of a problem here that when Pesach is over, if chametz was owned by a Jew, it then becomes forbidden to use after Pesach. It will be a problem after Pesach if the items were in the Jew's property over Pesach. And if it was owned by a non-Jew, we'll avoid that problem. There are similar things in other mitzvahs and other halachas that let's examine. There is a firstborn animal has a certain amount of holiness, a kedusha. When the Beis HaMikdash, when the temple stood, we would give it to a kohen, to a priest, and he would bring it. They would slaughter and bring it as a carbon, as a sacrifice, and then he would enjoy that animal. Today we don't have it, but we don't have that service, but we still have the holiness and the commandments associated with it. So if someone owns livestock, if they own kosher animals, not birds, but they own kosher animals, they have a herd of cows, they are going to come up with Bechor, which is firstborn, and that will just bring them heartache because they can't use that animal for whatever purpose, whether they want to use the animal for breeding purposes, whether they want to use it for the meat. They're not allowed to use the animal, even to work with it, they're not allowed to. It will just be a burden on them. It's going to be eating, it's going to be just, you have to let it just roam around, and therefore, a workaround is, again, to give a part of the animal to a non-Jew. If any part of the animal with the bechor, if it's a partnership in any small critical part of the animal, so that would be a workaround that would make that the animal, when it will be born, so you have to sell it before it's born, when it will be born, it will not have that inherent mitzvah and kedusha, it won't have the commandment and holiness of being a bechor. This was more applicable in previous generations when many more Jews own livestock and many more people own livestock than do today. Yes?
You lost me a couple sentences back. You have to sell it before it's born?
Correct.
And are we still on Pesach here?
No. So this is an all-year-round thing.
Right.
So once the animal is born, at that exact moment, the child will get that, will have that mitzvah, and the kedusha will have the commandment and the holiness, and it will be labeled as a bechor for its entire life. So to avoid that, you would have to sell a critical part of the of the child before it's born to a non-Jew, and then it won't get the labeling as it's born.
So that, again, I'm back to Pesach, because that's where my head was when I came in. So you could own that, or during Pesach?
So for animals, as far as we had so far, we had for Pesach, you have to sell your chametz. For an entire year, if you own livestock, you want to sell, whether Pesach, whether the whole year round, this is a totally separate thing, but just that it shares that common detail that you have a workaround by involving a non-Jewish ownership in this item. So by Pesach, you sell your chametz. It has to be a complete non-Jewish ownership. If you have a 50-50, it's going to make it 50-50 problem. But if you have an animal, even if you sell a small critical part of the animal, then it will be that will be fine, and the animal will be just like any other animal, and you can put it into your herd and enjoy the benefit, the profit, whatever you're doing with it.
So we're trying to just not give it the bechor.
Correct. A bechor today will just be a burden. It won't, because we don't have the ability to process it, to treat it as a bechor. Okay. Yeah. Chametz. So chametz is let's discuss that for a moment. Chametz is from 1 week a year during Pesach, during Passover. Jews are not allowed to eat or own any chametz. Chametz is items that are made with one of five grains: wheat, barley, rye, spelt, and oats, which were came in contact with liquid, primarily water, left in most situations, processed grains will be chametz. The exception is matzah. It's made with a special process, and it's matzah made with five grains, but it's not chametz. So almost everything made with these five grains is going to be chametz. So in addition to all other kosher rules throughout the year, there's 1 week a year where there's an overlaying set of rules. Not only are we not allowed to eat that chametz, we're not even allowed to own it. Or benefit from it. That's correct. Yeah, so 1 second. Hold on a second. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. We have time for everybody.
So, number one, and then I'll ask my
question. Yes.
Repeat the oats. You said wheat, barley, spelt, oats, and what?
And rye.
Right, okay. So, I have a question, even though we've done Passover before I was born. So, I just want to make sure my mother is talking right. No, I'm old. We would keep, like, well, Mommy didn't make her own challah, but I do, so I can keep my challahs, my wheat flour and the yeast in the chametz section in our house, and it gets labeled chametz, and then we also have loaves of bread and stuff. Just, we can keep them in the chametz part that we sell, and then
so that is correct. So many people, and we're going to get to that soon, that there's a common practice that people sell items of chametz to a non-Jew in order to avoid this prohibition. And we're going to discuss in our discussion today, hopefully we'll get to that part, of how it's done. By the way, yeast today is not chametz, so yeast does not have to be sold. I'm not talking about if you have a sourdough starter, but when you have, Fleischmann's yeast, or one of those, they do not have to be sold. I've seen in a certain kosher organization that lists in their chametz section, and I don't know why, because as far as I'm concerned, it is not chametz at all. It does not use chametz. You're looking at me, Sheldon, like I fell from the moon.
Gosh, I'm 200 years old.
So yeast is not bread. Yeast is a organism that is introduced, and it makes bread. Now, in times of old, they did not introduce yeast. Going back, 100 years ago, they would rely on the natural yeast that come in the process, and sometimes the bread would fail because it using those natural yeasts are not as guaranteed. And the same thing would be when they would make beer. They would use natural yeast from the barley or from the hops or whatever. Yeast is found in very many places in the natural universe. And there's different types of yeast. And again, I don't understand it fully. what yeast is. I do, just as an aside, just working in the kosher certifying business or agencies, there is a company that we go to near Colorado Springs that makes brewer's yeast. That's if you want to make beer, you will add brewer's yeast. And brewer's yeast actually is chametz. It is grown with and on barley. And it's actually in this place, it's kept in liquid form. And this place sells about 150 different strains of brewer's yeast. I mean, when you see something is a lager, something is a, you know, the pilsner, a lot of it has to do with the yeast that's used. It makes it a different profile and whatever. I don't understand it fully, but it's an extremely interesting facility that they grow the yeast. They have to have people there, I think it's 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, because if that yeast gets out of hand, they're going to be in a big problem. Bread yeast, baker's yeast is not chametz. It is not one of, made with one of the five grains. It is used, they were able to pull out the organisms that, and they say organisms, they're not bugs, they're you know, single, I don't know if they're single cell or something like that, that lay dormant. I'm sorry? So they lay dormant, and then when you activate them, especially for those that bake, you put them in a warm, moist environment, and whether you do that to the yeast before you add it to your before you add it to your mixture, or whether you proof it after you mix it in and make a dough, that is what the yeast does. Yeast itself is not chametz. Okay, that's an aside. Yes, go ahead.
I'm not sure I heard you correct me on this. I probably did, but did you say that after we've sold the
chametz,
that we can't take it back and never use it again as a Jew?
No. So if it was sold to a non-Jew, then during the Pesach week, or 8 days, as we keep Pesach, if it belonged to a non-Jew during that time, then it is allowed for anybody. It's allowed for a Jew afterwards. So in the strictest sense of the word, let's just assume that King Super's down the block is owned by non-Jews, and we go in there as soon as Pesach is over, and we buy bread or cereal or whatever it may be that is chametz, great, enjoy it. Now, Israel Kosher Deli is owned by a Jew, so if he sells his chametz like he does, then you can also come in here right after Pesach and eat the chametz. But if he would to neglect to sell the chametz, and he retained ownership of it over Pesach, then we have a problem that doesn't go away. That stuff remains forbidden for Jews to have to partake in after Pesach is over. So if it was owned by a Jew over Pesach, it remains forbidden forever on that item. Yes?
Where does this come from?
Very good. So in the Torah, it says not to eat and not to have any benefit from chametz throughout the Pesach. And the fact that it becomes forbidden if it was in your possession during the week of Pesach, that it becomes forbidden even afterwards, is of rabbinic origin, which is in the Gemara and the Talmud. Okay. Yeah.
What happens, let's say you made a mistake and something was not with your sold stuff.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I don't recall right now whether I don't believe that you're allowed to sell it. I don't know whether you're allowed to donate or not. I don't recall right now what the halachic status would be. But by the way, it doesn't have to do with where it is. It means there is a common practice, which is a correct practice to do, that any chametz that is being sold should be put away in the most preferable way is to have a specific room, if not to have a specific closet. Or even if it's not a specific closet, it should be covered. To have it, that it should be totally removed, we shouldn't possibly come to use it over the Pesach week. But even if it wasn't, if you did sell your chametz, it would usually be included. Again, it would depend on the exact document, but most cases today, that would be included. But there are cases where people have neglected to do it. There are cases that fall through the cracks. There was once a case, I've heard this, I haven't verified where or when this happened, but I've heard such a thing that happened, that there was once a case where after selling the chametz to a non-Jew, and as we do it today, we do it in a communal way. We do it, a lot of people from one city, or perhaps all the rabbis in the city do it to one fellow, and it has happened over the history that they found out that the fellow was actually Jewish. So, yeah, that's a problem. It's not a thing of pardonable. It's not. It was obviously done. Unfortunately, it was something that you know. Let's just say that they did their due diligence, but they failed to realize. We're not worried about the sin, but the after effects are going to make that if you had a $100 bottle of bourbon sitting in your cabinet, bourbon is considered chametz for the most part. Again, ask your local rabbi for the exact details, but for the most part, we would consider a chametz. That bottle of bourbon may have to be thrown out. So we'd rather do it correctly. So let's discuss that. So we don't sell it today. We don't sell it to the rabbi. We sell it through the rabbi. Let's get to that. Hopefully we'll get to those details. There's a decent amount of details here, and let's move along. And if there's anything that I say which is not understood, ask me right away. Anything else, you know, let's try to get them as we can. Okay. So we discussed chametz, we discussed bechor. Let's discuss at least two more examples that can come up. One of them is in Eretz Yisrael, we know that the land of Eretz Yisrael is a special mitzvah, a special commandment that every seventh year we don't do agricultural work in Eretz Yisrael and Israel. There were 100 and change years ago when people started moving en masse to Israel. There was an issue that people believed that there would actually be mass starvation if they would let the land lie fallow for a year. And the idea came up to sell the land to non-Jews for that year, and that would allow them perhaps to do agricultural work. It remained a controversial issue until this day, and it keeps on. There's lots of hundreds of pages of the documentation and halachic literature about this topic. It is a very, very interesting, both from the historical, from the political, as well as the halachic part of it. It's an interesting related topic. Another one is that if someone owns a business which is required, preferably we like our businesses to be closed on Shabbos, every seventh day we should have a rest. That's a mitzvah. And let's say a person, especially businesses which are required to be open on Shabbos, or they're required to have non-kosher food. So let's say, for example, a person is in the nursing home business, very Jewish, a lot of Jewish-owned nursing homes, and it's definitely required to be staffed 24/7, and they have to have not only, you know, nurses and staff, they have to have electricians on staff, they have to have maintenance on staff, they have to do all things necessary on the weekends as well. And if someone owns the business, a lot of times it will be necessary to have a Shabbos workaround. Sometimes it can involve a non-Jewish partner, and the partnership will be arranged that let's just say it's a 50-50 partnership, they'll arrange that 3.5 days a week it's technically yours, and 3.5 days a week it's technically mine. It's not a 50-50 every day, and that way, this is an oversimplification of a complex issue. Okay, so those are some examples. Now, getting back to the chametz part of it, there's as we have discussed a little bit, but just to bring it out, there's two parts in the reason for selling chametz. One is we want to, for ourselves, if we own chametz, if we have bread in the freezer, if we have bottles of bourbon, this is something which we would like to sell because we want to partake in it after Pesach. Another thing is that we want to make sure that other cell, besides for the fact that we'd like to save them from owning Chametz over Pesach, we'd also like to make sure that we're able to purchase from them. It's in my interest that Yisrael Kosher Deli should sell their Chametz, because otherwise I will have a more limited selection where I can shop after Pesach. So in that mode, let's think of a classic, an example that's a very relevant one. Are we familiar here with a business entity called Restaurant Depot?
Yeah.
Okay. Some of us may. It's a chain of very large stores.
Say it again.
There's a chain of very large stores.
What's the name?
Restaurant Depot. They sell to restaurants. Any corner restaurant that you got, they need to buy things in bulk. They need to buy specialized items. And these stores sell it to them, and they're the wholesalers, but they're not selling in used by the truckload. They're selling instead of selling meat by the pound, they're selling it by the 10 pounds. They're telling it, sort of like a Costco, but they sell it without tax, because the tax is going to be on the end buyer, and you have to be a licensed either a business or a nonprofit or whatever to utilize their services. It's a huge entity. I don't know if it's at all publicly traded, but the primary owner of it, the primary owner is a Jew from South Africa. This fellow, I don't know his level of observance and whether he would want to sell his chametz on his own accord, but it definitely is within the public interest that this business should be sold over Pesach. And in fact, there's a kosher agency in New Jersey named the Chaf Kei that you see their symbol on some products. They arrange to sell this fellow's chametz for him every year. Which leads us into the first question that is a halachic, I would say a controversy somewhat. How can we sell a business which continues to operate over Pesach? So what is this fellow doing? Let's just say, I don't know the details of how the Chaf Kei does it, but I'm just assuming that they do it like standard. We sell all chametz, let's just say, in the Denver community. People go to their rabbi, whoever it may be, and many rabbis together, whether it will be all rabbis or a couple rabbis get together, and they'll have a non-Jew who they know, and they'll sell it to them on the day, the eve of Pesach, and they'll sell it for the duration of Pesach. Now, normally, in our houses, if we have some chametz, it will be locked up, it will be set aside. We're not going to steal stuff that belonged to the non-Jew. But in when you sell a business and that business continues to operate, we have a little problem, because they are continuing to operate. He's not going to be giving the profits. The whichever non-Jew Restaurant Depot is being sold isn't coming around collecting the money from the cash registers or from the credit card funds after Pesach. I'm pretty sure about that. So how can we say that this sale is okay? So this is not something that came up today or yesterday. This is probably 100 years old or more where entities have to be sold. And this is something common practice is to allow this. One of the reasons to allow it is that let's assume that the items are sold, but the non-Jewish purchaser agrees that anything which is removed from the premises will not be part of the sale. Now, let's back up a moment. Let's discuss practically how the sale is done. Let's back up even a little more. Why was the sale necessary? Contrary to what many people who sell chametz for many, many years may think, this is not a custom that is as old as chametz is. This custom began just a couple hundred years ago, and it began in a very small setting. It was just individual selling. In the 1500s, roughly, the industry of liquor took off. Prior to that, the hard drinks that they had were beer and wine, mead. The whiskey business. What?
No Shlomovitz.
So the whiskey industry took off in the 1500s. When it took off, there's obviously a chametz concern. The primary grain that's used to make liquor is barley. There are some other grains. Bourbon, for example, has to be over 50% corn, but it's there are other grains used, but one of the primary ones is barley. So we're talking about a chametz drink. And it was a very Jewish business for reasons that I'm not 100% clear, and regardless of the reason, it was a very Jewish, heavily Jewish involvement in the whiskey trade. So they had tremendous, they had storage rooms full of barrels that were worth a lot of money, and to get rid of it was a very big loss, and therefore decided came up, they didn't originate the idea, but that's where it came from, that they would do the sale. Now, prior to that, it was not really necessary. Let's discuss why. Almost everything that we can think of today, why we want to sell chametz, didn't apply. They didn't have freezers, so there was no frozen baked goods. They didn't have many hard drinks because, well, whiskey wasn't invented, or it was, even if it was invented, it wasn't popular. Beer was made on a small scale. Much of it was not, some of it was not made with barley. Today, almost all beer are made with barley. Some are wheat, which again is chametz, but they do have some fruit-based ones. That was very common. So getting rid of chametz wasn't a very big deal for them. In fact, the concept today means the Shulchan Aruch discusses, Shulchan Aruch was written in the 1500s and discusses the basic details of halacha. Shulchan Aruch tells us that it describes a law that's come based on the Talmud. Seems like they would bake fresh bread every day or two, including on Pesach. They would bake fresh matzah. Matzah as well didn't last the way our matzah does. It may not have been the same tasty, crunchy cracker that we have today. It may have been a softer version, but the Gemara discusses that what happens on Pesach if you're not sure if the matzah is the Pesach version or the chametz version. So the Gemara tells us you can tell by the freshness. You can tell by how recently it was made. So they were constantly making new bread. I don't know what they did with sourdough starters, but again, maybe you can get one from your non-Jewish neighbor. It's not such a complicated procedure, and there wasn't that real need. Again, people didn't have huge houses with discover that old bottle of something back in the corner of their couch. The houses were simpler, the menus were simpler, and there just wasn't that large need. The Shulchan Aruch in one, on the source sheet here, in the first source here discusses, the Shulchan Aruch has, just the way it's broken down, is that it has chapters, and then it has subchapters. In the Shulchan Aruch, throughout the, let's say, 50 chapters or more that it deals with Pesach halachas, only one subchapter, only one comment is related to the sale of chametz. It says, what should you do if on Erev Pesach, if on the eve of Pesach, you're stuck with some chametz, so make sure to sell it to a non-Jew. That's all it says. You could read it in the first source there. But when we get to the Mishnah Berurah was written a little over 100 years ago and is a six-volume compilation on the Shulchan Aruch. The Mishnah Berurah brings many of the later details and explains a lot of things in Shulchan Aruch. The Mishnah Berurah on this one halacha takes up. Hold on a second. It takes up 7 pages. So you see how, as the generations went further, and this halacha became a very, very practical one. Yes.
How does the evolution of corporations and having Jewish shareholders play into all this? Is it a majority issue?
It's a good question, and I didn't explore it fully. There is a concept of majority, and it's a little bit beyond my the purview of today. It's a broader question of corporations in general. How about large partnerships that aren't necessarily corporations? Let's say you have 10 partners. Is that a bigger problem? Let's say you have publicly traded companies where invariably there's going to be a Jew there, right? What do we do then? Or how about if you're a shareholder in Post or in General Mills, right? What about that?
Or this guy who owns Restaurant Depot, he can't just sell his clothes because he doesn't own it. His corporation owns it. So does he sell his stock?
Right. It's a good question. That's a good question. Yeah. Okay. So that was why the need to sell. Now, the reason why there's an added level why it became a little more complicated. When the Shulchan Aruch was saying that if you're left with a little bit of chametz, you sell it to the non-Jew, it was a pretty simple procedure. Let's say you're left with a loaf of bread. What do you do? Quickly, what do I do with this loaf of bread? You go over to a non-Jew, and either he'll give you a couple dollars or not, and you say, here you go. And the primary way to make a halacha valid acquisition is for them to either bring it into their property or to lift it up. Those are the two normal methods for them to do an acquisition. Both of those, lift it up. They lift it, and that makes a halachic acquisition. Okay? So just because you gave money for something doesn't make that a halachic acquisition. When it comes to selling in this type of situation. So the problem would be when you have a cellar full of barrels of whiskey, obviously it's not going to happen. You're not going to, you get it hard to lift it and hard to even bring it over to his place. You want to sell it where it is, in its cellar. So that required a lot of halachic ingenuity, a lot of discussion of which type of halachic acquisition details to do. Today, it is very common that when it's sold to the non-Jew, they do multiple acquisition methods in order to be very, very sure that it's done correctly and it does not remain halachically the acquisition, the ownership of the Jew. And you can see that in source number C. Source C. It just says, it says make sure to do, and to read the last line, one should definitely attempt initially to have an acquisition which is approved by all. You should. So they do multiple ways. And for this very reason, we do the sale of chametz through a rabbi. Originally, this was something, as the Shulchan Aruch says it, you just went to your next door neighbor, knocked on the door and said, here you go. This is the little bit that I have left, and take it or sell it, whatever. Or buy it off me.
I give it to you.
What?
I give it to you.
Right, you to the non-Jew. Right, or if it was something valuable, you can say, here's the $100 bottle. Quick deal, $20 is yours. Whatever the details were. But it wasn't something. It was something done on an individual basis. And originally, when communities began doing a communal chametz sale, some rabbis had the idea, let me acquire all the chametz for myself, not just as a way to make it simpler. Instead of today, the way it's commonly done is that the people will appoint the rabbi as a messenger, that he'll be the proxy to do it, and many times he'll come to the sale with the non-Jew on the Yom Pesach, and he'll have a stack of papers, and he'll have all different, and he's doing a sale on behalf of, hundreds of people, perhaps. But the reason why halachically it is better for the rabbi to be a proxy, they realize after a while, because, and if we sell it to the rabbi, then everything will belong to him 100%. And then let's just say that the acquisition that's being done to the non-Jew, we try multiple ways, but we're never 100% guaranteed that every last T is crossed. Now, again, this is not casting aspersion on the way we do it. We're doing it in a way that we are comfortable that it's halachically the best possible way to do it. But to say that the rabbi should take on his shoulders, and I'm buying everyone's chametz, even though I don't need that food, I don't need every last person's thing, and then to have it on my shoulders that I am selling it to get rid of my obligation to get rid of chametz, is just, there's no need for that. Rather, let the rabbi be the proxy, and then we'll all together as a community, we are selling it to someone, whoever, whichever non-Jew we choose. Now, the second, there's two very big questions that came up in doing this type of sale. Number one is, a lot of times there's a question of legality. This question began in the 1700s. I think in the late 1700s, this question was raised by many rabbis. In many different, in halachic literature, we find this question brought up multiple times in different forms. So, for example, there were certain, the Chassam Sofer who lived in Pressburg, which was in, I believe, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Someone asked that there was certain legal procedures that had to be done when you were buying or selling things. And they asked, I believe it was the Kaiser who was in charge, they asked him why he doesn't charge these taxes or, you know, these legalities, why doesn't he enforce them? And he said, oh, it's just a religious thing that they're doing. So they asked the Chassam Sofer, they said, if it's just a religious thing, then it doesn't have validity. It has to be halachically, it has to be sound. This has to be a sale. This is not just to make a... play. It's not a fiction. It's a legal loophole. It's a way to get it a proper acquisition that it should not be in the Jew's property over Pesach, but it's got to be valid. If there's laws in place and they're saying that this is just a religious thing, there are laws that are not being followed. This is not a going with the proper steps. Let's add a modern twist to this. Let's say we have today someone wants to sell their business, which includes alcohol. So let's say it's a store that has a section where they sell hard alcohol, chametz, or it's a liquor business, and selling it usually involves a license. Right? Legally, you're not allowed to sell that business unless the person has a license to it. Every state is different, and every municipality probably is different, but these types of things, how do we make this sale without those details? Selling it without the taxes is a little less, we can answer that one, because the taxes is a right for the government to enforce. They're allowed to enforce it. The reason why, let's just say that we're selling $100,000 worth of chametz to a non-Jew, the reason why I, as the seller, am not enforcing the tax is because I'm not a store, I'm just selling to my neighbor. Now, let's just say that there's a law in the books that when you sell an amount over whatever it is, I have to charge tax. Many times it's just that there is a law in place that the taxes could be enforced. It's not that it invalidates the sale. So the fact that if we were to ask the United States Tax Department or the state tax or the city tax department, and they would say, well, it's only a sale for 8 days and they're just doing it because of religious reasons, because of that, we're not going to enforce the tax laws. That's fine, because the sale was never going to be invalidated. It wasn't a question of invalidating the sale. But when you're selling something without a license, many times there may be such a law that the sale may not be valid. Are we?
Yes.
Okay. Another question that was raised, and this is a question related to some of the other forms of selling that we mentioned earlier, Bechor and businesses for Shabbos. The question is, there's a concept in halacha called harama. Harama means a trick. When I sell you something, which me and you know that we're just doing it for a specific purpose, We both know that there's no way in the world that this is going to last. What is the validity to such a thing? Now, when we sell the chametz, how do we do it? Let's just say that, let's say a rabbi has his congregants come together, and generally on a chametz form, they'll ask for some type of detailing. What are you selling? Are you selling household items? Do you have a store involved? Someone told me that he was by a chametz sale in Brooklyn, and there was a bunch of rabbis there together selling to a non-Jew, and they said, just for the sake of just understanding the scope here, is anyone representing a single entity with more than $10,000 or $100,000 worth of chametz? And one of the rabbis got up and he said, yes, one of my congregants has a shipping container full of chametz that is on the sea somewhere, worth a lot more than that. So we're dealing with potentially huge amounts of chametz. The non-Jew does not pay full price for that chametz for a number of reasons. Number one is we don't know the exact price, right? The rabbi's coming. He doesn't know what this guy and what that woman and what this family and what everybody has in their house. Even if they tell him, he's not going to know the exact value. Second of all, who is laying out that money? What they do is they make a deposit. They say, this chametz has a certain value. They try to estimate. They try to say this value is, between $1 and $40 million, whatever. And the deposit is going to be $25. The rest of it will be required to pay. They usually make a time after Pesach, at which if the buyer, the non-Jew, wants to go through with the sale, we're going to make a complete estimate and figure out the final dollar amount, and they'll have to pay the rest. And if he decides at that time to drop the deal, it will be invalidated from that point on. It won't retroactively invalidate the sale. So that way the chametz sale is valid, and all they have to lay out is $25. And generally the common practice is that we do it with a non-Jew and we sweeten the deal a little bit. He usually comes, let's say, with $25, pays for the chametz, and then when Pesach's over and he comes back, they'll usually give him $100 for his services. Right? That's sweeten up the deal. But it is a done in a way when we say, is this yours? Yes, it's completely his. And many times that non-Jew who is chosen, he'll be the caretaker in the synagogue or something. And for those 8 days, he's actually very likely the richest person in the city on paper. So doing something like that where the sale is done correctly, all the boxes are checked, that it's a valid sale, it's a halachic sale, it has to have a validity in court, it has to have some amount of legal validity. Again, that was the question we had before. There's certain cases where it will be questioned, but with all the legality. But we all know that in every case, the non-Jew is going to drop the deal. Right, which that's expected.
You pick him that way.
That's true. I mean,
what did you say? You pick him that way.
I mean, there is a rabbi in Baltimore who I was told, again, I don't know if this is true, but I was told that every year he instructs the non-Jew to pick one person from the list and actually go into their house and take an item, just to strengthen the idea. Everyone should be very clear that it's actually a sale. Don't think you're getting away scot-free. So he's actually going to take something. No, I was told this is Rabbi Heineman, but yeah, and I know who you're referring to. So it is a valid sale. So the question is something which can you say it's a haroma? It's a is there any problem? And this is a idea that has multiple aspects, and there's proofs back and forth. The bottom line is that we do it and we say that it does have validity, but the question remains, and again, it's an interesting question, how about by the selling an animal for Bechor, it's a little bit easier. Because over there, we are actually making a partnership with just a tiny critical part of the animal. So we will usually, if someone owns livestock, they'll, I believe the documents have that they sell part of the animal's esophagus, means every animal on the farm. They'll sell a critical part. So he'll be a partner for a one, you know, let's say 1% of the animals. So that, again, that works. So here it's a little easier to understand the concept of it. But when you're dealing with the chametz, where we need it to be 100% in the non-Jew's possession in order for the chametz to be allowed after Pesach, there we read the question is asked. Yes.
What you're not saying, which occurs to me now, that maybe you should have said at the beginning, which is, this is, and you alluded to it, this is a relatively recent custom that we have, that Jews have, that this is all done not in Torah times, it's done in modern times, and therefore we've depended on the rabbis to come up with these fixes.
Correct. And even more than that, today, because our lives are so complicated, because we have large houses, because we have, sometimes we even have, you know, we have things in our cars, we have things in a storage unit, we have things that we don't even know we have. So the rabbis today suggest for everyone to do a mechiras chametz, a sale of chametz. And in addition to the reason that you don't know what you have, it's so much easier because the rabbi is making a sale of chametz regardless. Right, every rabbi or every city has entities that have to be sold. Right, stores that have to be sold. Stores have huge amounts of chametz. Businessmen who have large stocks of chametz. I don't know. I'm saying stocks in chametz companies. Again, that was a previous question.
No, if you're an attorney, you've got an office. You've got soda pop.
Well, soda's not chametz, but yes, you're going to have chametz. You will have chametz. Yeah. Correct. So the rabbis are doing the sale of chametz anyways, and for us to add stuff to that is not a very difficult thing to do. And over there we can do that. There's an interesting note on this that what happens if someone usually comes to a rabbi to sell his chametz, his or her chametz. The rabbi knows, you know, this person comes every year. And one year the person doesn't come, which probably is because they're not in the greatest of health. Let's say they're going through some type of a health crisis, or they may have forgotten to do it, but they do it every year. So it's not 100% halachically soundproof to do this, but there is a basis for it that the rabbi can say, I know that they want me to do it for them, and therefore I'm going to do it this year as well. So to get up and say that, oh, we're going to sell the chametz for all Jews in the universe, would be making a mockery of the entire thing, because we know that the people that Jews who unfortunately might not even know what chametz is, who might not know what a sale of chametz is, might not know why there's a problem to have chametz, to say we're selling for every one of those, we're not being honest with ourselves. It's more on if a person generally comes. Or let's just say that there are people who may have sent their authorization in the mail, but we never got it. So we'll include that in our sale. That's a little easier because they actually did authorize me. I just never received them. So to make it even more solid and to make it a more more genuine, both in the eyes of the common people, to make it more genuine for everyone involved, it is a common thing that a person will come in person to a rabbi and will give them a document, not just say, oh, rabbi, sell my chametz for me. They'll give them a document of sale that many rabbis will have them put in the details, like we mentioned earlier. Some of them will make a type of a acquisition. They're not acquiring the actual chametz, they're acquiring the fact that they're going to be a proxy. Right, correct. More than permission, they're getting the power of attorney. Right, correct. The old thing would be that the rabbi would have a yarmulke, something he would say, you know, pick it up. I used to go to a rabbi once upon a time that he had a special yarmulke embroidered on it, said Mechiras Chametz, sale of chametz, and he would do that. But those are things that are all extras that are meant to just solidify and make it genuine and personal. That's 21st century. Addition, right. Yes. That's a good point. Okay, any questions? Let's open the floor to questions. There's, yes.
I have many questions. But
yes.
It's a little afield, but not. I always, the problem I always come up with is pets and pet food.
Yes.
And I love my pet, but I'm not going to spend an exorbitant amount of money for a separate food that I might have to buy here or wherever.
So let me just digress for a moment and discuss what is the halacha with pets. Means, what is the halacha with pets over Pesach? So the halacha is, and this was in source D on the page, that one is not allowed to feed their pets chametz. Now, that does not mean you need kosher for Passover food. And there are many things that, besides chametz, that we have customs, different communities. The first pit has A, B, C, D, E, so it's D. You're not allowed to feed an animal chametz, and that applies even to animals that don't belong to you. This can come up if people visit a zoo on Pesach. You're not allowed to feed chametz, whether you own it or not, to an animal. Now, different depends on the species of what the pet is, will depend on how big of an issue it is to avoid chametz. I have a friend who has a dog. He told me that his dog does not eat chametz the entire year. He said the food, no, not because of religious reasons. He said the food that he gets does not have any chametz in it.
No, my dog eats a combination of salmon and sweet potato.
Okay.
It has no grain in it.
So
of course it's kidney.
Right. I don't own a dog. I don't know the details of how common it is for different species, and yeah.
No, I'm trying to bring it back.
Well, yeah.
What about if I sell my animal and I sell the
No, 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 that is a great question. That's a great question. Go ahead, please.
I sell my animal and I sold the food because it's chametz. So I'm taking care of this animal for somebody else at that point.
Right. That's a great question. So I believe that in source E, in the Hebrew part of it, I believe that it gets into detail there. In the English, since I couldn't find a good translation online, I had to write it myself and I shortened it. It's a good question. I believe that it is a problem for you yourself to feed it. The question would be, let's say to have someone else care for it, and I believe that it is not the best, but I'm trying to remember the exact details. And again, you're talking about genuine chametz. You're talking about grain, real.
Yes, grains in the animal.
Some of the grains might not be one of these five, right. But we're talking about, yes.
But I'm assuming there's chametz in the
Read the ingredients. I wouldn't assume
I
that.
But
let's.
For the purpose of the
right,
question.
Right. Correct.
Again, I don't own the chametz and I don't own the animal.
Right.
Am I not allowed to take care of someone's animal, the chametz?
I believe that we are not allowed to because we're not, the halacha says you're not even allowed to feed strays, even if it doesn't belong to you.
Yeah.
The reason is, again, because there is a, again, I think this relates a lot to the 21st century, that we get a pleasure when feeding animals, otherwise we wouldn't do it. Right, and even right. Right. Yes.
I just last year we got a rescue dog and we called OU even though we had, and they said as long as the food is grain free.
Right.
And and one of the OU people said not cooked and then then grain free that we can be okay.
Right. So there's a detail that you may be related to that. Animal food that has milk and meat cooked together is problematic all year round. So you're allowed to serve an animal milk and meat, and you're even allowed to put them on the same dish together. But if they were cooked together, not only is a Jew forbidden to cook them together, but if they were cooked together, it is also forbidden to have benefit from it. So
how would I know that from the package?
So if it has, it would have to be a meat of a kosher species, not of a kosher animal. So if it has, so if it's pork and milk, great, good to go. If it's a dairy, if it's a cow milk and milk, then what?
A beef byproduct.
Right. If it's a beef byproduct together with a milk.
Okay, how do I know that?
It says non-cooked on the back.
So right, if you look, if you read the ingredients, you could get a pretty good picture. There is a company, at least one, maybe more. There's a company called Evingers. I don't know. I don't own a pet, so I don't know if any of you who do is familiar with this. Evingers is a company that makes a dog and cat food. I think primarily they make canned food, but I'm not sure. And they got a certification just for animals. So it's a certification from the CRC in Chicago, just that their stuff are kosher for animals. What?
For Jewish.
Correct, correct. So just that it doesn't have milk and meat cooked together, and that it is, and some of them do not contain chametz. Yeah. So again, I think it depends on the variety. I think many of them don't have any of the grains. Some of them do. I know that there are someone told me, I have an uncle who likes fish and he had different types. He said that he would use mealworms for Pesach. He would introduce them a few days before and he found it to be fine. Mealworms might be gross, but they're not. No. You freeze dried. Freeze dried mealworms. Yes. So yes, you have already sold it. In most cases, in the generally today, when we sell our stuff, we say I'm selling any chametz that I have. Now, if someone didn't do that, I mean, let's say a person authorize the rabbi to sell the chametz in their house, and they find chametz in their business or in their car, there may be an issue. Again, this is a question to ask in a specific case, but for a general way, it is included in the sale,
so
and it would not be a problem. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Quinoa. So quinoa is not chametz. It is a grain. So again, grain does by itself doesn't mean it's chametz. Rice is not chametz. Now, the question with quinoa is there's the Ashkenazi custom to avoid kidneys, which is legumes, beans, you know, things of that sort. What does it include? So does it include, so we know that Ashkenazim will not eat garbanzo beans, rice, things like that, which Sephardic communities generally do. Some eat only certain things. The Syrian community, very large Syrian community in Brooklyn, Israel, they will eat rice. They will only, and rice products, they will look through the rice three times. So they'll search. It's one of the big jobs in the house before Pesach is to check the rice.
And what are you checking for?
So they're checking for any foreign grains.
Okay.
One of the five grains, actually. So I have a friend who's from the Syrian community in New Jersey, and he told me as a kid this was one of the big jobs, one of the very tedious jobs. And he has one of his uncles was saying, come on, there's never anything in there. If somebody finds a chametz grain in there, $10. And believe it or not, someone found a grain of barley in there. I don't know if they ever found one since then before or after that, but it could happen. And again, especially in the days of old when they didn't have the machinery that they have today to sort through them. Today they use all types of automated machinery to sort through items. Right? How often do you find in anything different in a you know, any type of produce that you buy, any type of, you know, my father always complains that you buy a bag of potato chips and there are no burned ones in there. He said when he was a kid, he used to get a couple of them that were well done, you know, but today it's the quality control is such a big thing. So they tend not to have these burned for the same reason when you buy produce, you don't find, you know, random things in there, which, believe it or not, there are, right? When they sort through grain, wheat or barley, I was by a flour mill. They said every once in a while they find screws in there, they find they find, you name it, they find insects, they find all different types of things. You don't find them in your produce because it has been sifted out. But so quinoa is a question whether for Ashkenazim it's allowed. Most of the kashrus agencies today do allow it, but it's not a clear cut. It's a more recent question. So for Pesach, they say it should be certified because there are actually, they do use grain. Again, I don't know what the process is. Is it milled somewhat? Is it some, they do use grain processing or something?
Then you also have to, unless it says it's already checked, you also have to check it before Pesach?
You're talking about for insects? You're talking about for
grains?
What? For chametz? I haven't heard that. To check the quinoa?
Yeah, before
there
Pesach,
is a,
unless it's pre-checked. Because
right. I believe that they say it should have some type of certification, and I don't have all the details in front of me right now, but that's the basic thing is that most kosher agencies do allow it for Pesach use. Yes?
Again, this is a little far afield, yeah. I have a free question and a question. We use the Shulchan Aruch all the time, or let me personalize it. As an Ashkenaz,
so Svaradim will use the Mishnah Berurah to a certain extent. The Mishnah Berurah was written basically, it was written for Ashkenazim. So they'll take it with a grain of salt. The same way, in a smaller way, the Mishnah Berurah was written in Poland. There are some people that have different customs. They say, I come from Hungary, and over here we did X. So they'll take it with a little bit of their own, you know, they'll...
We don't take the Shulchan Aruch.
So on the Shulchan Aruch, there's the Ramah. The Ramah was a Ashkenazi scholar,
right,
who is a contemporary of the Shulchan Aruch, and he added his own notes into the Shulchan Aruch, which incorporated much of the Ashkenazi rulings. Now, it's not 100% rule that always the Ashkenazim will follow the Ramah and the Sfarad. Right, right.
So
yeah.
here's the second question.
Yes.
Maybe a field of what your field is.
Which field are you in now, left or?
So once upon a time, not so long ago, because when I was younger, the issue of spices, teas, coffee didn't need a hekshar for a Pesach because, again, some of it is a quality control, but things are just more supervised, not supervised with a little. So as we've gone forward, it's now I have to have my spices with kosher Pesach label. I have to have my coffee, my tea.
So some of these things.
I'm saying that.
Is that true?
I'm asking the question because.
Some of these things are sometimes things have changed. Some things remain the same, but we have the availability to verify them. So there are certain things that could change. Coffee, for example, is one of the things that doesn't necessarily need a certification. Some of the larger brands, we'd like to know that there's no other flavored items, there are no other products being done on the same lines. So for example, many of the larger brands, Taster's Choice is one that is approved for Pesach. By the way, if you use coffee grinds, that's okay to use without a Pesach certification. Spices is the issue is that today could be it's more of an issue. Correct. So even if you buy new, the same facilities are processing spices and would process many spice mixes, which is something that may not have existed. Spice blends, in other words, the pink or crumb blend that contains chametz is going to be processed, is going to be repacked in the same facility that's repacking your paprika. Not here. I'm talking about in the, you know, McCormick or whatever, whoever's. So that's why originally single spices are, for the most part, kosher or Pesach. And once upon a time, again, I can't say this for sure, but very likely the spice facilities weren't making as complicated mixes as they are today. as complicated food-ready blends with the 5 grams.
Okay.
So perhaps that's a reason.
Like I said, it's a little far.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. Okay.